Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. Russian and Syrian government planes today killed at least 45 people, including children, in a town in eastern Syria, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory said the strikes hit the town of Qura in Deir ez-Zor province, which borders Iraq and is mostly controlled by the Islamic State militant group. Meanwhile, the Syrian Democratic Forces rebel group, a coalition of Kurdish and Arab forces backed by aerial support from the U.S.-led coalition, clashed with IS inside Manbij, pushing into the key stronghold of the extremist group from its southern edge. Manbij had been a major supply stop for the IRS. The International Organization for Migration reports at least 19 Ethiopian migrants found dead from suffocation in a containerized truck in Zambia. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The International Organization for Migration report says they were crammed into the truck carrying bags of beans and groundnuts. IOM spokesman Joel Millman tells VOA this particular incident was widely reported in the Zambian media.
There were almost 100 in the container. You know, happily, most of them survived, but you can just imagine. I think it was last year or 2 years ago, there was an incident of drowned migrants who were being seen eaten by alligators or crocodiles. So we know it's a really tough migrant route, and some of the casualties have been horrific.
Millman says migrants routinely die while being trafficked, but this incident represents the largest number of known migrant deaths. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Italian officials say at least 7,000 migrants have been rescued from small boats in the Mediterranean in just 2 days. Italian ships, along with others belonging to Doctors Without Borders, carried out more than 40 rescue operations, pulling people from small rubber boats and dinghies. The migrants are believed to be from Arab and sub-Saharan countries. This is VOA News. The militant group Al-Shabaab attacked a hotel near Mogadishu's airport today, setting off a massive explosion followed by gunfire. According to police, a suicide bomber set off a car bomb outside the hotel, killing at least four people and wounding nearly a dozen others. Leaders from the six European Union founding countries are in Berlin today for an impromptu meeting to discuss the future of the EU after Britain's vote to leave the Union. Along with Germany, representatives from France, the Netherlands, Italy, Belgium, and Luxembourg are all gathered at the German Foreign Ministry building on the outskirts of Berlin. Within hours of the announcement that Britain would be leaving the EU, world leaders began expressing disappointment. Christine Lagarde of the International Monetary Fund.
It will be some time until we know the nature of the future relationship between the United Kingdom and the European Union. In the meantime, it will be important that there be clarity on the negotiation process and that it be carried in as smooth a manner as possible.
Here in the U.S., President Obama spoke while attending a conference in California.
But while the U.K.'s relationship with the EU will change, one thing that will not change is the special relationship that exists between our two nations. That will endure. The EU will remain one of our indispensable partners.
Not only leaders responded, but the world markets on Friday also reacted, with the U.S. Dow Jones losing 6% and the British pound hitting a 30-year low. Two people are dead in the western state of California and more than 100 structures destroyed as a wildfire that started Thursday afternoon in Kern County near the city of Bakersfield continues to burn out of control. Tyler Townsend is a firefighter in the area.
Well, it started right at a base of a mountain, and when you combine those three elements that I spoke about, fuel, weather, topography, you have light, flashy fuels, hot, dry, windy weather, and an uphill slope, that fire raced up the hill, and it's since grown significantly.
The people killed are reportedly an elderly couple overcome by smoke as they tried to flee the home with their home near Lake Isabella, California. California Governor Jerry Brown has declared a state of emergency for the county. The governor of West Virginia has declared states of emergency in 44 counties after the worst flooding in the mid-Atlantic U.S. state in 100 years killed 23 people. The damage is widespread and devastating, according to Governor Earl Ray Tomlin. Our focus remains on search and rescue. As much as 25 centimeters of rain fell Thursday, sending numerous rivers into southwestern and central parts of the state, over their banks and into the streets of the towns. The sheriff of one county said he's surrounded by complete chaos. I'm Marty Johnson in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
There are several expectations. What I do know first is that our visitation will bring a positive change to the institution and to that of the county and the country.
U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama plans to visit Liberia next week.
We have moved out the electoral timetable for the year, and that essentially started with the remission of the voters' register. That was in May up to June.
The Electoral Commission of Ghana says its preparations are on course to organize the November 7th general election.
Basically, as a result of the events of Monday, where our 5-6 program was concluded by the riot police coming and assaulting us.
And a Zimbabwean pressure group files an application to stop the police from preventing them from protesting against President Robert Mugabe. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama plans to visit Liberia early next week to highlight girls' education. VOA's James Batty is on assignment in the Liberian capital, Monrovia. He visited R.S. Caulfield High School, about 30 miles from central Monrovia, one of the places that Mrs. Obama expects to visit during her trip. He asked Vice Principal Steve Bunny about expectations regarding the U.S. First Lady's visit.
Firstly, it's a plus for the institution, the country, and that of the county. And there are several expectations. What I do know first is that our visitation will bring a positive change to the institution and to that of the county and the country. And the female organizations that we are working with, we do know that our visit will enhance their work.
What are some of the issues you have in terms of educating females here at the school or in Liberia in general?
Many of our girls have been vulnerable, and they have been a huge dropout as a result of teenage pregnancy, lack of support. But since the coming of those NGOs that work is centered around female, there has been a high retention rate of dropout, because they are being involved in the reproductive health education that has helped to cut down teenage pregnancy and basic education, making them to know their roles in society and making them to also not think that men are to do all, that they are also, that they can do what men can also do. So based on that, they have...
So they feel empowered.
Definitely, they have felt empowered since the coming of those NGOs working with them.
So why do you think your school was chosen? Why was your school chosen for the First Lady of the United States to come and visit you?
There are several reasons. Let me just name few. R.S. Caulfield academically has been on the country's map for her academic performance, and we have worked with several non-governmental organizations as it relates females. And we have been doing exceptionally well. So I don't see Mrs. Obama's visit to be a mistake, because we have been well known both national and international with good records, academic and all of, and extra activities like agriculture, vocational, and that of sports.
So if you had a message for the U.S. First Lady, what would be your message?
My message to her is to continue programs that will help empower our girls and that will maintain them in school until they can get what level of education they all hope to get.
Mr. Bunny, it was nice to talk with you, and thank you for giving us this time to talk with you. And congratulations, and keep on the work you're doing.
Thank you very much for coming. It's a pleasure, because I've always heard about you, and I haven't been fortunate to physically see you. So I think this is a very great opportunity for me.
Steve Barney is the vice principal of the R.S. Coffield Heights School. He spoke with viewers James Batty in Liberia. The spokesman for the Electoral Commission of Ghana says the electoral body is implementing measures in an effort to be ready to administer the November 7 elections. Eric Jakpasu said the Electoral Commission is satisfied and comfortable with its preparation efforts to organize the polls. Jakpasu told me the Electoral Commission's preparation so far indicate the electoral body is on course to organize a credible and transparent general election.
We have rolled out the electoral timetable for the year. And that essentially started with the revision of the voters' register. That was in May up to June, where we undertook the limited voters' registration. That was an exercise where we gave the opportunity to all those who could not register during the previous registration exercises, maybe because they had not attained the age of 18, maybe they were out of the jurisdiction, or for one reason or the other couldn't register. We have finished that process. We are now at the stage of printing of what we call the provisional voters register, which now captures the new applicants who are registered in the limited exercise, after which we will be exhibiting the voters register. The exhibition exercise is slated for 18th of July up to the 7th of July 2016. This is an exercise where we update and clean the voters register. Essentially, the opportunity is given people to go and check their data as captured during the registration period so that people can make corrections to their basic data. In that same exercise, those whose names inadvertently were omitted from the register can now apply for inclusion. It is also the opportunity when we print the register of unqualified persons, of minors, of disease, etc. So, once the exhibition is done, the register is printed and certified. The polling stations have now been updated. The commission intends using 29,000 polling stations. And as we speak, we have 28,921 polling stations, including three centers. Once we finish the exhibition exercise, we move into the stage where we receive nominations in September, and hopefully we'll conduct the elections on the 7th of November.
So is the Electoral Commission satisfied with measures it's implemented so far in readiness for the election?
Yes, so far the measures that we have implemented in terms of the revision exercise where we've captured new applicants onto the register, the demarcation, the creation of new polling stations, and the preparations we are making for the division of the voters register, I think we are on course.
So what is the working relationship, or for that matter, partnership between the Electoral Commission and the participating political parties or political parties that want to participate in this year's vote?
Relationship between the Electoral Commission and the political parties in Ghana has always been cordial. We meet frequently at the inter-party advisory committee level where we exchange ideas and we build consensus on issues that innovation that we want to bring into the system and we mark the way forward. So I would say relationship with the political parties so far so good.
Let's go back to the voter register that will be used for this year's election. Though the process is still ongoing, we recently understand the Supreme Court made some ruling. Now, others are speculating that the ruling could thwart efforts by the Electoral Commission to be ready for the elections. Will the Electoral Commission be ready following the ruling?
Yeah, following the ruling, the Supreme Court made very specific clear-cut orders yesterday, and we are supposed to go to the Supreme Court back on the 29th of June and present a list of people who registered with the National Health Insurance card far back in 2012. Who later were declared to be ineligible to be on the voters' register. This list we're going to present to the Supreme Court and then submit a written memo on the set of procedures that we're taking to delete such number of people from the register in readiness for the election.
Eric Jakpasu is the spokesman for the Electoral Commission of Ghana. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. The 11th global meeting of the National Transfer Account, or NTA, network ended this week in the Senegalese capital, Dakar. The meeting looked at African demographics and population, including the role of youth, women, and the elderly in fostering economic growth. During one of the side event sessions, panelists discussed about Africa's demographic dividend and the elderly. At the end of the discussions, for VOA, reporter Alpha Jalu caught up with Andrew Mason, professor of economics at the University of Hawaii and co-director of the National Transfer Account Network. He asked him about the role of the elderly in the demographic dividend.
Well, I think the elderly are make a lot of contributions to economy and to society. Some of these things are not measured, but they nonetheless are making those contributions. So they take care of their grandchildren. They contribute to their community in various ways. And they also are a store of knowledge. They can be very important, particularly in agricultural societies, but also many other contexts. So I think that's the first thing. The second thing is that elderly in most countries are the wealthier people. They've had an opportunity to save throughout their lives. Our analysis shows that when you have more elderly, you have more wealth, you have more capital. That raises people's wages. It helps economic growth. So that is a very important thing. And then a third contribution that the elderly make is that they are can be social insurance, especially for their families. So sometimes youth, maybe they come in the job market and things are not very good, or maybe there's a economic crisis and unemployment rates rise, and they can go home and live with their parents or their grandparents and get their support. And we've seen this in countries during the great economic recession that we've gone through in recent years.
Now, most elderly persons are taken care of at a certain stage in their age. Does this mean that elderly persons drain the economy, or they are what we call economic liabilities?
Well, it's certainly true that the elderly are producing less through their work than they're consuming. So there's no question about that. And in a lot of countries in the West, the elderly are supported by public pension programs and health care programs. So they depend on that a lot. It's also true that they probably contributed a great deal to those programs when they were working. And so, in a way, this is just a return on the investment that they made. And then a lot of elderly are relying on their own assets that they accumulated while they were working or inherited. We don't find that the elderly are, there's a lot of transfers from young people to the elderly, but there's a lot of transfers the other direction. So those flows go both ways. And in many countries, the elderly are giving as much as they're getting.
Now, by measuring demographic dividend, do you have specific projects where elderly people are being...
I don't. No, I don't think we do have specific projects. I think we have more ideas about what kinds of policies would be favorable to the elderly that would be complement the demographic dividend. One of the most important things is to provide a secure economic environment. The elderly depend a lot on their assets, and they need to save when they're young and they're working. They need their wealth to be preserved, and if there are crises or revolutions or terrorism or terrible economic policy, well, that destroys wealth, and that's very bad for the elderly. So we want to be sure that with demographic dividend that we really make sure that we have sound policies for preserving wealth.
And finally, can demographic dividend provide jobs for elderly persons who have, perhaps they have retired, but they are still active?
Well, there's no reason why they can't do that. In the United States, I don't often use the United States as a good example, but in this case, the United States has no retirement policy. And in the formal sector, in most countries, they have a mandatory retirement policy. And I think that's a terrible idea. I think people should be able to work as long as they're able. Now, of course, when they're in the informal sector, when they're a farmer, there's no retirement policy. They continue to work. And so I think that's very important. And that's mostly a matter of policy.
That was Andrew Mason, a professor of economics at the University of Hawaii. He spoke with reporter Alpha Jalo in Senegal. Opposition in Tanzania has accused President John Magufuli of political intolerance after he told them that elections were over and there was no time for cheap and divisive politics. Magufuli's remarks follows last month's indefinite ban on political rallies. Gideon Shu is a Tanzanian veteran journalist. My colleague Douglas Mbuga reached him in the commercial capital Dar es Salaam to find out the reaction to these remarks.
I think the reaction is mixed up. You have the reaction from the elite, which is quite different from the common man. Magufuli has a reasonable following of the common man, and it doesn't seem like he has disturbed them. But the elite are a little bit shocked and concerned. They feel like this signals the muzzling of democracy. I'm not saying all of them, but I say quite a significant segment of the elite. Not comfortable with that statement.
And the opposition has reportedly dismissed President Magufuli's remarks as being unconstitutional and a dismarked of political intolerance. Is this view widely held among people?
Not widely, because I have a feeling that there is a misunderstanding here. It's a question of giving the right interpretation to what Magufuli has said. You can interpret what Magufuli said in one way or the other, which is absurd. My feeling is there is a message he wanted to send through. There is a problem in this country of politicking, and I think Magufuli was aiming at that. I think what he meant is there's been a tendency around of political parties or political activists using politics to derail people from the main cause of action, and that creates a problem. For instance, there is a move right now in this country to collect tax from all segments of the economically active society. Now, if you find a politician calling a political rally and criticizing the move to sensitize people to pay taxes, I think that is politics. I think that is negative. I have a feeling probably that is what that's the message President Magufuli wanted to send through. I think so. Because I don't see him as a president elected by the people of this country using a living constitution prohibiting people from practicing politics. It is not practical. We have political parties, and political parties do politics. That is what they are there for.
But now the police earlier this month put an indefinite ban on political rallies for what they called security reasons. Do you think this augurs well in a multi-party political dispensation?
No. I think the police force has no mandate to call off political rallies. What the police force is supposed to do is to make sure that political rallies or political activities are held in a safe environment. So unless they have proof that there is a move to harm public peace, otherwise I really have serious doubts with the ban. I don't think it's something which augurs well with the country which claims to be pursuing democracy.
Lastly, how serious is the opposition resolve to boycott parliamentary sessions chaired by the deputy speaker?
Well, I see them boycotting, and I for one I'm surprised because I don't think this is what the electorate sent them to do in parliament. They did not send them to walk out. I think they should have stayed in there and aired their views. By walking out, it means they are not saying anything. So even the electorate doesn't know their position. So they want to create a parallel parliament using political rallies. It doesn't work like that. So I, for one, I don't think that is a very tactical move, because I'm not very sure whether they're going to achieve what they want to. Actually, I even don't know what they want to achieve by not attending parliamentary sessions.
Do they have genuine grievances they have to put across?
But why don't they put the genuine grievances across in parliament? In parliament, we have galleries full of journalists. Even if not in there, but even outside, they are journalists. Tell them exactly what the problem is with the parliament, so that they go to the public, as you know, the public opinion court.
Gideon Shu is a veteran Tanzanian journalist. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Dar es Salaam. Five members of the Zimbabwean pressure group Occupy Africa Unity Square, who were assaulted by the police while demonstrating in central Harare recently, filed an urgent application in the High Court to stop the police from barring them from protesting against President Robert Mugabe. For VOA, Thomas Chiripazi has details from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
In papers filed with the High Court in Harare today, the applicants are arguing that the police have no right to bar them from protesting in any peaceful manner. One of the applicants, Dirk Frey, tells Studio 7 that the assault of his group's members by the police while demonstrating against President Mugabe was illegal.
Basically, as a result of the events of Monday, where our 5-6 program was concluded by the riot police coming and assaulting us, we have then approached lawyers in order to file an urgent application at the High Court for an interdict against the police from interrupting our programs.
Another applicant, Linda Masarira, says the assault by the cops has actually strengthened their resolve to demonstrate until Mr. Mugabe leaves office. Masarira says the police action was illegal as the national constitution allows freedom of expression and peaceful demonstrations.
It does not deter me. It actually has made me stronger because it shows the level of repression that the state wants to put on the general populace of Zimbabwe, that no one can say anything against this evil regime. But this has made me stronger. I'm now more resolute and more determined in my quest to see a better Zimbabwe.
Masarira's sentiments were echoed by Frey, who insists that their mission is to be accomplished very soon.
As we have been maintaining since we have begun, that we will not let anything disrupt us on basis of principle, that what we are doing is completely constitutional and we have a right to be doing this, as well as from the point of view that we have not yet achieved our objectives. So we will not simply stop in mid-game, so to speak, simply because some misguided people are attempting to intimidate us and hamper our efforts.
Masarira urged Zimbabweans to come out in their numbers and fill the streets to show their anger on Mr. Mugabe's administration.
We are working on strategies of mobilizing, and support has been good, but now we're trying to find a way to demystify fear in people, because you know what it's like with Zimbabweans, they're so filled with fear of the unknown. So we're really trying to capture them, to make them understand that we need to do this collectively as Zimbabweans to achieve the result that we need.
Other applicants are Pride Mukono, Tatenda Mombearara, and Patson Zamara, who is the brother of missing Occupy Africa Unity Square leader Itai Zamara, who was abducted last year by suspected state agents. From Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
Thank you.
And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. And right now, it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy.
Ah, yeah. If you like. Mambo Vangora, Marameta Mozambique, Sabu Sahara, African melodies. Bless you, my motherland. Say, I say, Viva Africa, Viva. America, let me see in Africa. Eh? Ilopiano,
Caribbean,
Navanatino. Havana of Africa. We love in everybody. When you come to Africa, feel at home, nobody. No matter where you're from, don't worry, my friend. It's so wonderful when people meet. Viva Africa! Shake your body as a scream and shout. Life is too short. No matter where you come from, Africa is your home. Scream and shout. Come dance with me. Chesa, chesa, hey! Chesa, mziki, chesa. Africa, Eddie Kenzo Africa, hey, Mama Africa.
Tende mama handi Ata basi kiri Tende basi kiri Na mashini kandi Mama gulu wanikanyo We mikono wanikanyo Wama chusa nendondo Tengu kone kenyondo When you see me I'm stress free I don't wanna stress you no no When you see me I'm stress free Mama honey, pata basi kiri, twende basi kiri, na mashini gani, yeah, 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 brrr, weka juu, eh, weka juu, mikono juu, eh, mikono juu, cheza tu, eh, cheza tu, mikono juu,
Saka.
Oh, Kati, what a Kati. Oh, Kati, and don't get put up at the school. This school, this school, this school, this mama honey, what a bicycle, this school, send the bicycle, this a machine gun, this school.
Bidum bido, you drive me crazy. Bidum bido, my love.
Untala bidum bido, nandem bidum bido. Untala bidum bido, nandem bidum bido.
Baby, you turn down the soda. You fucking shaking your shoulder.
And you know, I enjoy your presence, you know. You know, you know. Ay, 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 ay.
Go by one and funnest on you. Go by one and sit on my ziga. Oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah.
Baby Kea, baby super, na sitima ye guanja kira. Baby Kea, baby super, waka bintu ni lingala.
Marunja chirenku, gunda nga kapiro. Untana mbiro mbiro, nange mbiro mbiro. Marunja chirenku, gunda nga kapiro.
soldier. You're my woman strong, heater in the winter.
Music from the continent, we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and engineer for today, Mark Ferguson, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, we do not inherit the earth from our ancestors, we borrow it from our children. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There is plenty of evidence that if peace efforts are to succeed, women must be involved in the process. But too often in the past, women have been shut out of participating in peace negotiations and peacekeeping. That is why, 4 years ago, the U.S. Department of State released the U.S. National Action Plan on Women, Peace, and Security, which seeks to ensure that women participate equally in preventing conflict and building peace in countries threatened and affected by war, violence, and insecurity. The Global Peace Operations Initiative, or GPOI, is a part of this effort. It is a U.S. government-funded security assistance program that works with partner countries to deliver the training and tools needed to help stabilize countries in conflict and support United Nations and regional peace operations. One of GPOI's key tenets is to engage, consult, and protect women in all aspects of peace operations. And so, of the nearly 200,000 personnel that GPOI has helped to train and deploy to peace operations worldwide, more than 6,000 have been women. Latin American nations have a long history of peacekeeping operations, so, working with regional partners, GPOI has helped develop and build a regional mobile training team of U.S. and Latin American experts on gender issues, human rights, organizational development, and peacekeeping. Now they are mentoring future peacekeepers in Latin America on issues such as enhancing the role of women in deploying peacekeeping forces and training peacekeepers to better interact and engage with the women in the societies they are charged to serve and protect. While working to address the growing global demand for peacekeepers, the United States remains steadfast in the effort to increase the participation of women as peacekeepers, as well as expanding their role and leveraging their perspective, all of which help protect other women in some of the world's most challenging global hotspots, wrote Stephanie Purdy, a program analyst for strategy at the State Department. By encouraging and supporting collaborative training initiatives with leading peacekeeping contributors, we build upon our partners' historical peacekeeping perspectives and create an avenue through which to exchange expertise, experiences, and ideas, which in turn creates more credible and effective peacekeepers.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.